I'm Jerry Davis. I'm the artistic director of Burning Coal Theater Company. I'd like to welcome all of you to Into the Fire, the Burning Coal Theater Company podcast series on all things theatrical and occasionally some things that aren't. Today, we have a very theatrical subject. Mr. John Gulley from the University of North Carolina Greensboro's Theater Department is joining us. John, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you here. John is directing David Hare's Skylight for Burning Coal, opening on October 6th. That's the show that will open our 20th anniversary season here at Burning Coal. John, what was your first experience with Skylight?
I read it years ago and didn't appreciate just how good it is at the time. And then I saw the revival. Was it 2 years ago or last year?
I think it was last year, yeah.
With Bill Nye and Carrie
Mulligan.
Yeah. Which was, their performances were stunning, but the whole production was just revelatory to me. It was not until then that I appreciated just how good a play it is. It's one of his best, I think.
I agree.
And we can talk about a little bit later about why I think that is, but
yeah. Well, and is Hare a writer whose work you had done before?
I've never directed a play by David Hare. I've seen a fair amount of his work and read a good bit. He's such a prolific writer. I know there are some that I have not gotten to, but I can still remember a production of Pravda, the original production of Pravda at the National Theater.
Tony Hopkins,
In the 70, was that 78 or 79, something like that. I was there. This is another sort of connection with Skylight. I was there in the winter of discontent when Leicester Square in downtown London was literally about 10 to 15 feet high with trash, rubbish, as they would say. It was the rubbish strike, that was the sort of bleakness as we transitioned into the Thatcher years. But anyway, I can still remember Pravda was just like Skylight, although I think Skylight's even more successful in wedding the human and the political. I mean, David Hare is fundamentally a political writer, but at his best, and at any playwright at their best, is wedding ideas, in this case, political ideas, with a human story. And I think Pravda mostly does a good job of that. Although in Pravda, I'm a little more aware of Hare bopping us on the head a little bit with his ideas. And there's nothing wrong with that. It just makes it not quite as compelling a piece of theater. One of the things I think that makes Skylights, the main thing I think that makes Skylight such a great piece of theater is the way he weds the human and the political, so that the political ideas still come ringing through, and come ringing through, I think, a little more clearly because they're so bound up in the relationship between those two characters. And I think when you think of the political writers of theater, past and present, you know, George Bernard Shaw, David Edgar, who you love rightfully so much, they are at their best. The real thing, Tom Stoppard, you know, they're at their best. He's more of an idea. But when the ideas are enmeshed in the human story, And as opposed to, again, sort of preaching at us or knocking us over the head.
I would add Brecht to that list as well.
Yeah, and Mother Courage is amazing. Yeah. Yeah. But some of his other plays, especially some of the early ones, you really feel like he hasn't quite figured out the play, theater, human thing, and he's sort of hitting us over the head with it. But Mother Courage, you know, is a beautiful combination of the two.
It's a human story in many ways. Yeah. Brecht often was most successful when he was not quite achieving what he set out to achieve.
Absolutely. I mean, I think when I read something like Mother Courage or see a good production of it, I think, you know, Brecht, you kind of missed the boat here on, you know, you kind of misunderstood your own dramaturgy, I think, in a way.
His adaptation of Edward II is quite an extraordinary piece of theater as well. The adaptation of the Marlowe play.
Which I've never seen stage, would love to sometime.
Saw it once at Yale Rep years ago. It's not easy to stage, but it's such a, so much clearer and better a play than than the Marlowe is, I think. He really consolidates the focus down. But we've gotten slightly off the David Hare track. It's interesting that you mentioned Pravda, because Pravda was a fairly thinly veiled account of the rise of Rupert Murdoch in England and really throughout the Western world. And with Skylight, I guess Terence Conran is kind of a model for the character. He had another play called My Zinc Bed a few years ago that kind of focused on a Bill Gates-like character. Mm-hmm. So he seems to, Harris seems to want to take these somewhat conservative, very successful businessmen, mm-hmm. Give them voice, mm-hmm. let them articulate their position. And I find that rare in theater. Is it something that draws you to a play, not just with David Hare, but with any writer, that they are able to give full voice to the opposition, as it were?
Absolutely. And that doesn't mean just in, you know, political plays or plays about ideas necessarily. But, you know, I think coming up with a story, writing a plot is challenging. I've always thought and I'm not a playwright, but I've always, one of the reasons I'm not a playwright is because I do, as a director and an acting teacher, I have such an appreciation of how difficult it is to flesh out even just two different characters on stage and maintain those voices throughout. It's so easy, especially in didactic, say David Hare at his worst. He's still good even at his worst, but at his worst, the characters can all start to sound the same because they're sort of preaching an idea for the playwright. Great writing is like in Skylight, where these two characters are fully voiced, all three, but especially the two, are fully voiced, fully dimensionalized, fully realized. And you find yourself as an audience member bouncing back and forth between the two. So you go, wow, he's making really good sense. And then she says something, no, that makes sense too. You know, George Bernard Shaw at his best does that. And he'll have 10 characters on stage, all fully realized, fully voiced. And they make it that when they're writing at their best like that, it seems so easy, as well it should, but it's hard as heck. And, I am drawn to political plays, but I am mostly drawn to plays where the character, where the playwright fully honors each character's voice, even if that character is a little bit, from our point of view, slimy or not particularly likable, you know. And that's obviously a truism for actors too, is you don't judge the character you're playing. You have to fully inhabit that. And a playwright like David Hare, I mean, I'm sure there are things that you don't agree with, that things that Tom says in the play, but I also know that you're a good enough actor that you're going to fully honor that. And then when Emily Reader's doing it from the opposite end, we got a crackling good play that's both about two humans going at it, but also two different ideas crashing into each other. Ideas about how a government, a country works. And it's, boy, talk about being appropriate for now, not just obviously in the UK, but in the United States, where we're dealing with this whole notion of the 1%, the 99%, and what obligations does a government have to its people or not? And they're compelling arguments on both sides. And what's one of the many things that's so wonderful and fascinating about Skylight is how he fleshes out those ideas. And they're,
yeah, there's a little Donald Trump in Tom. I think he's certainly a more erudite and considered character than Trump. But that was certainly one of the reasons why we wanted to do the play this election.
No, it's
year.
great timing.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk, you mentioned your work at UNCG a little bit. You've been there now for
24 years. I've lost count.
And tell me, what do you do there? You're the head of the acting program?
No, or? I'm the head or coordinator of the MFA directing program, but I also teach in the BFA and MFA acting program. So I teach acting and directing, and I'm a Meisner guy. Sanford Meisner was an acting teacher back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, well into the 70s and 80s. One of those part of the big three with Stella Adler and Lee Strasberg, but they all three come out of the Stanislavski, the Konstantin Stanislavski tradition, the great 19th century, 19th, 20th century Russian acting teacher and director. And so that's sort of my shtick, my speciality, as it were, is doing Meisner, which is all about getting actors to work simply and honestly off of each other. And so you can imagine, I'm just drooling to get to work with you and Emily on Skylight, because it's two characters, three characters when you include your son Edward, but two characters primarily, who are two actors who just have to be present with each other, and this space is just perfect for it. It was very compelling on Broadway in a big Broadway house, and I know you saw the same production. You also saw the original production, but you know, there's something different's going to happen in a wonderful way when the audience is right on top of this, practically living in the flat, in Kira's flat. And I can't wait for the moments of where I would love for the audience to be looking for the exit signs a few times when this play reaches a fever pitch, as it does on a number of occasions.
When the blood starts to flow.
Exactly.
A little bit. Yeah. They're a passionate couple, and they do. I one of the things that attracts me about the play is that I don't ever have a sense that they don't love each other, and that they aren't exceptionally well designed one for the other. Is there something in that that's useful to us as a culture?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I was just thinking that very thing, that, you know, somehow we've gotten to the point where if you have a fundamental political, economic, whatever disagreement, then that sort of finishes things off. And, you know, we've got to find a way to be in the same room and have passionate. I mean, it's just what you say. They love each other, not just in spite of, but even because of their ability to accept the others, even if begrudgingly, ridiculous, silly point of view, and still find a way to live. They love the give and take, and they're Benedict and Beatrice in that sense, from Much Ado, or, you know, they love that the crackle of debate and sparring, and you know, too often, and not just our political debate, but even you know, I think we all have personal relationships that are a little bit frayed right now, because we can't seem to find a way to argue and fight and then go out and have a drink together or have lunch or, you know. I think we're going to be fine. We've made it this far as a country, and it was. I think most people know this, but some don't. You know, back in the day, say when Jefferson and Hamilton were battling it out, and Jefferson and Adams. I mean, today's like a picnic. I mean, compared to how they went at each other, and
lives were on the line.
Yeah, and I mean, talk about lying about each other and making stuff up and being absolutely evil and cynical.
And the yellow journalism.
I'm not saying that's cool, and we should be okay with that. No. But I'm just saying we will survive,
and we have made some progress in the meantime.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And as dire as things seem, you know, with ISIS and, you know, the police killings of late, because we're doing this and this recording this in the summer, you know, the history is actually moving away from that. We are in the most peaceful time ever. You know, fewer people are dying in wars than ever. You know, fewer people are dying. Things are going to be okay. We just have to all take a breath. And
there's more acceptance of different types of people, and more value on the human being than I think through at any point throughout history. I sat in a very interesting conversation yesterday with a group of people who were discussing the relative value of classics, and at no point did anyone in that conversation say, well, the classics are one of the tools that has been used to move society forward. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a terrible omission, a terrible failure on the part of that speaker to acknowledge that while dramatic literature, in this case, which was the subject, may have its flaws, as do all human endeavors,
right.
What would our world look like without, for instance, To Kill a Mockingbird from the 20th century,
right.
or Uncle Tom's Cabin from the 19th
right.
century? What would our society today look like without just those two works of art, those two classics? And yet that didn't seem to be part of the conversation. It was an omission that I think we make at our own peril. David Hare has been accused of that sometimes. He's often accused of being sexist. Many of his stronger characters are male characters, and he writes within a particular ethnic milieu,
right.
almost without exception, although one of his most recent plays, Beyond the Beautiful Forever, was set in India, in a slum area in India. So
maybe he's accused of being patronizing the Indians in that though.
It was an interesting play, not a particularly successful production, I think, but the play script I thought was quite good, an adaptation of a nonfiction book. Yeah.
I think you're right, and I think I think David Hare may be guilty of some sexism in his plays, and one could, I'm sure, find it in Skylight, but as you're implying about all works of art, all good works of art, that you take them for what they are. If there's sexism in it, you notice it. Now, obviously, it can cross a line, but at which point it becomes not literature, but truly, truly something hateful and destructive. But you just you notice it, you accept it, you embrace it as the historical artifact of its time. David Hare was a particular guy writing at a particular time when he wrote Skylight, I guess in the early 90s. It was his first production was 95, is that right?
That's something my like recollection.
That. 95, 96. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons we do a play like Skylight. We do any play is because it's a picked snapshot of its time from a particular angle of view, from David Hare's particular angle. I think his angle of vision happens to be very useful, as always, a little bit flawed. And so I agree. It troubles me when we decide that a play, a work of literature, whatever, is not perfect in this particular way, so let's just move on. Well, they're not. Human beings are incredibly flawed.
Right.
Works of art are, if it's a good work of art, it's going to be limited in a certain way because it's going to be that person's particular point of view.
From that particular time.
And sometimes plays that are try to be broad and sort of cover everything and are maybe more palatable in a certain kind of way and a little more comforting, but comfortable, but not as challenging. I mean, just look at, we're talking about Shakespeare before we started the podcast, and there's, my gosh, you'd have to, is there any play that of his that you couldn't reject if you said, a play cannot be offensive to anyone or challenging to anyone?
Must meet these standards,
view,
or we ain't doing it.
Yeah.
And of course, there's some legitimacy to that argument, but you have to ask the question again. In my opinion, what would society look like if that work of art hadn't existed?
Right.
And my suspicion is that in almost every case, it would look worse. It would
right.
not be a positive thing. John, you and I met back in the early 90s. Do you want to tell the listeners, assuming we have any, about how we met back in the early 90s?
Yes,
New York?
I was hired by Theater Fest, which I think is no more, but it was a summer theater company out of Montclair State University, which has a terrific theater program, still does, in Upper Montclair, New Jersey, what, about 20 minutes outside of the city on a good day.
Yes,
on
sure.
A bad day, maybe 2.5 hours. I was hired to direct Trip to Bountiful with Ellen Burstyn. They would do shows with a sort of bring in a star. And John Wooten, a mutual friend of ours who ran the Theater Fest, was always good at not just getting stars, but actually darn good actors who happened to be stars. And so this production of A Trip to Bountiful, Horton Foote's beautiful, beautiful play, and set in Texas. This particular show was built around Ellen Burstyn, and we cast you and a number of other people in that show. And it was, I think it was a darn good production. And I'll never forget when the production moved to the Phoenix in Purchase, right?
SUNY Purchase, that's right.
SUNY Purchase. It played for what, 3 or 4 weeks in Upper Montclair, and then the artistic director of the, what did it call, the Phoenix?
The Phoenix Theater, yeah. Bram Lewis.
Bram Lewis, and they were performing at SUNY Purchase. I brought it up there for a couple of weeks, I guess. And I remember, I remember one being up there. Maybe it was the opening night up there, when Ellen Burstyn, playing Carrie, finally says goodbye to her house in Bountiful, Texas, just not too far outside of Houston, at the end of the play. When she said goodbye and looked back that last time, there was just the tension and the electricity was palpable. And somebody in the balcony, I was sitting in the orchestra, you could hear a woman actually caught her breath. I mean, she just broke into a sob. And it was electrifying. Ellen was just, and you can speak to it more because you actually got to act with her and be backstage with her, but she was a total joy. Just obviously an amazing actress and so giving. And we had wonderful fights, she and I, about, because she was trained with Lee Strasberg. And of course, I'm a Meisner person. And they Lee and Sandy were not exactly best pals. And so Ellen was wonderful because, kind of like Tom and Kira going at it in Skylight, the two of us could go at it about, I would tell her, you know, Lee's full of crap, blah, blah, blah. And she'd say, oh, Sandy's, you know, and we just had a great time. And I'm sure she was a joy to work with on stage.
And I, the Uta Hagen actor, was watching with mirth from off in the wings. For those of our listeners who don't know, Ellen Burstyn is an extraordinary film and stage and television actor. Who, among other accomplishments, remains to this day the only actor ever to win a Tony Award and an Oscar in the same year.
Back in the 70s.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, she won the Tony Award for Same Time Next Year, the same year that she won for Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, the Martin Scorsese film. So she is an extraordinary, remains one of the... probably two or three greatest living American actors, I would say.
And I think most younger actors and young people know her from Requiem for a Dream, which was about 8 or 9 years ago, I guess.
Or maybe The Exorcist.
Or The Exorcist. But Requiem for a Dream, if you've not seen that, she's just... As unbelievable as ever.
Yeah. There was one night at, I believe it was at Purchase, when Horton Foote had come up to watch the production or work with us a little bit on it. And he was on stage for the curtain call, and Ellen was on stage. And somehow there was me right in the middle of them. And the sense of love and warmth coming down from the audience onto those two people was something I will never forget. Yeah, she's a good one. And that whole company, many of them I still keep in touch with.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, Horton Foote is another writer. I mean, very different writer than David Hare, obviously. Not overtly political in the same way, but all of his plays are political. And, you know, all of his plays are about people mostly from his part of Texas, from different backgrounds, grappling with major differences and different points of view, infused with that Horton Foote sense of optimism that, in spite of all, partly because of all, we will persevere. And of course, we're sort of the circle of life kind of thing, coming back to Kill a Mockingbird, because he wrote the screenplay for To Kill a Mockingbird and deservedly won the Academy Award for that. And I think he was the perfect person to write Mockingbird, because it's a play about fractiousness and fighting, but ultimately the perseverance of the human spirit. And you know that anyway.
One of my favorite writers, Aaron Sorkin, is adapting it for the stage for a Broadway run next year, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, I saw a very nice production of it that the Open Air Theater in London had done 2 years ago, and Robert Sean Leonard was doing Atticus in it. My wife Simi and I saw it at the Barbican. It had gone on a tour and come back into London at the Barbican. It's one of the best nights I've ever had at a theater. And I think some of the producers, the Broadway producers, came over and saw it and decided they liked it, but wanted to do an original script version. And so they've hired Aaron Sorkin, who is one half tier below God in my mind.
Yeah.
Just a remarkable writer. So I'm very much looking forward to that as well. John, is there anything you'd like to say about the program at UNCG? I know it's a big part of your life now, and you've generated some of the most accomplished actors that we have here at Burning Coal.
Including Emily Reeder, who will be playing Kira.
Playing up.
Who graduated from Enloe down here.
She's not too good, is she? No, just kidding.
she studied with the wonderful Sue Scarborough at Enloe and then Enloe, came to us, and we just sort of buffed her up some. And then she went off and got her MFA at Northern Illinois. And is coming back to the Triangle area. So no, I mean, I'm biased obviously, but I love our program. It's about 300 majors across a number of undergraduate and graduate programs, but it's primarily one of the things that I like about it is it's a very focused professional training program. We don't have a PhD. We make our students, replays and take theater history and stuff like that. But I think some programs I've been connected to almost try to do too much, try to cover too many bases. And you know, sometimes we feel like we're trying to do too much too, but we are focused on turning out professional actors, professional directors, even professional dramaturgs and designers and stage managers, and our students and across all those fields are working in the field in North Carolina, Triad, Triangle, Wilmington, in DC, in New York, and LA, and Chicago, and of course, they're often waiting tables during the day, or at night and auditioning during the day. But there is something different when you're teaching students. I mean, I love small liberal arts programs too. I came out of a wonderful small liberal arts program at Wake Forest, but there's something different about when all the students I teach are heading into the profession. They may end up going to something different, but they all passionately want to be there. And I'm here today partly to work with your wonderful conservatory students. And I get the same feeling here, even though I know not all of them are going to go stay with theaters professionally or something. There's a kind of passion, a wonderful disease that these kids have, yes, that they just need to be doing this.
It's such a difficult industry to get into. I say to parents more times than I can count that it's the one business that you can do everything right and never make a dime off of it. If you become a good enough plumber, you know, somebody will hire you,
right?
But that's not true of acting,
right?
And so it must be difficult for you to see those students going through and to know that the odds are so heavily against.
No, that's true, and of course we are brutally honest with the students and with the parents when they're visiting and thinking about it, and we try to talk them out of, you know, if there's anything you would like to do other than be an actor. Now, if they want to go into design or stage management, there are jobs out there, and we have probably close to 100% job placement for our tech students. So any of you prospective actor types out there, please think about design or stage management, because there will be a job there. But the flip side, I totally hear what you're saying, but the flip side, and I know you know the flip side too, is that the kind of training you get in theater is all of our students are working. They're all gainfully employed. They may not be acting, all of our acting students, they're all. But you know what you learn, and it almost sounds cliche, but it's so true, what they learn about problem solving. What's your kids this summer? Even the things that are not specifically being taught to them, they are learning about problem solving, about collaboration, about working with people in all sorts of difficult, challenging situations.
Being timely, doing things.
About being timely, being disciplined, being focused, being able to repeat something, you know, on a regular basis. And especially like our students who go to New York and look for work, they get work, and I tell them this and they don't believe me, you will get work the first day or certainly the first week you start looking.
That happened
because those companies are whatever kind of company, you know, whether you're working in as a receptionist for Citibank or working in a restaurant, they are desperate for theater kids. Mm-hmm. who are good problem solvers, have good communication skills, will be disciplined, will show up on time. And so we do tell the parents that, but obviously, you know, it, as you say, it is, it can be very challenging and very discouraging. But hopefully at the least, besides teaching those skills, it will build character.
One of the things that I've seen happening over the last really 15 years or so, that was not so much true when I was living in New York back in the 80s and 90s, is that that a lot of young people are kind of pairing up or grouping up together with people that they like, and finding a corner of the world and making their own art. And of course, that had happened in small ways throughout our countries, certainly in the 20th century. But now it seems like it's more of an accepted idea. We're not going to sit by the phone and wait for the Broadway producer to call. We're going to go out and make our own art, and we're going to compete for an audience with the Broadway producer or the regional theater producer. And I find that a very positive development.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And as you say, the basis of it is just like-minded people meeting at someone's living room and reading a play. And if it doesn't go beyond that, that's fantastic and thrilling, and feeds artists that we both know in New York in a way that, you know, just doing the daily audition grind or even just taking the everyday sort of class doesn't. And then maybe that living room thing turns into Steppenwolf. I mean, that's how Steppenwolf started. Maybe that living room thing turns into Burning Coal. I mean, you and Simi just came down here and got a group of like-minded people together and said, let's just do theater. And I think y'all would still be doing theater even if you weren't as, you know, successful as you have become. You would still be finding a way just to meet with fellow artists in living rooms at coffee shops. And
we have a nice back porch. We could.
Yeah, exactly. And no, but you're right. That is, and a lot of, we have a lot of budding Steppenwolfs, not just in New York, all around the place, but especially New York is just a wonderful.
Brooklyn, a lot of.
A hotbed of these companies that there's so many now that, as you well know, because you're up there a lot like I am, you can't keep up with them all.
Right.
You know,
right.
And they come and go. I leave New York, you know, with regrets of, you know, three or four productions of little companies that I've heard about that I just could not get to, where they were sold out or, you know, and that's not even talking about the off-Broadway and Broadway stuff. I think we're in a kind of golden age of theater in a way. And I think the level of writing, and I love the way, the fact that you here at Burning Coal really honor contemporary playwrights. I think we just have... I mean, David Hare is an oldster now.
Oh yes,
David Edgar. You know, but young American playwrights now. I think it's amazing.
Marco Ramirez his play The Royale will close our season this year, and that's as good a play as I've read in the last 10 or 15 years.
And also, I think, you know, it's interesting. This connects with the David Hare, is more writers, and you know, we have Tony Kushner and writers of his ilk to thank. Are engaging with political ideas. There's nothing wrong with a good love story or a kitchen sink drama, but I think there has been a dearth of American writers, playwrights who are actually grappling with big ideas and political ideas. I think that's totally changing now, which is wonderful.
I feel that too in the zeitgeist. The British are pushing us in that direction, I think, and God bless them for it. John, it's been terrific talking with you today. We could go on for a couple of more hours, but our audio engineer would pick up something and hit me if I did. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Looking forward very much to working with you on Skylight, and God bless in all things.
Thank you.